Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob's new book, just out this month, Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Time, Space, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death, written with Robert Lanza. It's a brand new book, a very interesting book, and we'll talk about that today, and a lot of things astronomy related. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or go to Facebook, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. There should be a Vox Pop post there. Tweet us if you wish, at WAMC Vox Pop. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show. Congrats on the new book.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Ray.
This is one I promise I'm going to read all the way through immediately, and the introduction grabbed me. Before we get to any of the questions and some of the events today, let me read this, if I might quote from the introduction. The deepest, most vexing issues have not changed much since the beginning of civilization. People 8,000 years ago worried about death. Those in ancient Babylonia shared with us an obsession with the passage of time. Thinkers in every culture have pondered Earth and the heavens, and generally have seen them as existing in a space-based matrix. The nature of life and consciousness started to obsess us as soon as we came down from the forest roof and grew brains large enough to be tormented. It's a nice turn of phrase.
Thank you. Thank you.
What's it all mean?
Well, essentially, well, everybody wants to know what this is. What is this universe? This is what cosmologists tackle, but also what religions and philosophers have tackled. You know, what is this place we were born into? And we all know that the standard model from science, what that's about, a big bang happened 13.8 billion years ago, the universe is expanding, life started mysteriously, but presumably accidentally, 9 billion years after the Big Bang. And these creatures, including ourselves, have consciousness. We have awareness, perception. And using this consciousness, we look out at the universe. We see colors that, by the way, we create within ourselves. They don't exist out there. And we try to understand things. You know, that's the model. It's fine. The problem is that science has been telling us since the 1930s that space and time don't have any actual validity in and of themselves. It's not like they're not like cucumbers that you can analyze in a laboratory. They are actually tools of animal perception that we make sense of the universe using. So in this book, we show what science says about space and time. We explore consciousness, the tool by which we explore the universe, and see what other conclusions we come to. And we find that that a real model of the universe has to take us as observers into account, because nature and the observer, as more and more physicists are finding, are correlative. We go together. We show experiments that prove that the result you get depends upon whether you're watching or not. So in some way, we are linked with the universe, not as accidental chance people that just popped in by a fluke. We're not here by a fluke, but we in the universe go together and we explore this.
Is it our universe?
And come to very different conclusions about what the science is showing us about the real nature of reality and the universe.
So you wrote a book with Robert Lanza some time ago. This is a follow-up, right?
This is a follow-up, but it's the better book.
So what have you learned since the first book?
How to be clearer about this, how not to go on too long about aspects of this that can put the average person, maybe make them their eyes glass over. Just how to be clear about this. The original biocentrism did very well. We have, I don't know how many language editions and countries all over the world, but this is a lot better. And you can see on the cover, and on the back cover, we have people from Harvard and the editor-in-chief of Discover magazine and Astronomy magazine,
yeah,
raving and ranting. And on the cover here is Deepak Chopra calling it that this book will forever alter your understanding of your own existence. So I think we're pulling in already. This is the week that it's published, but we're already pulling in people from the kind of new age set to serious scientists.
You know, another great paragraph here in the introduction tells us, Science tells us with some precision that over 95% of the universe is composed of dark matter and dark energy, but it must confess that it doesn't really know what dark matter is and knows even less about dark energy. Science points more and more toward an infinite universe, but has no ability to explain what that means. Is this book more or less about what we don't know?
Well, first we have to see, honestly, what we know and what we don't know, but before we abandon it. You know, because if the present model of the universe is just fine and is giving us satisfactory answers, then why bother? You know, why reinvent the wheel if it's already there? But what we're showing is that the current model is not satisfying to anyone. You know, nobody we know, nobody I know, is satisfied with the idea of a universe that popped out of nothingness. And not just because in everyday life we don't see lawn furniture or kittens just boom, popping out of nothingness.
There's a reason for it.
So here supposedly there's an entire universe one Saturday morning that went bonk out of nothingness. Now, even if this is true, and it may be true, that's still no explanation for what we have. It's still a huge mystery.
But yet science as it stands now has many aspects that are testable and provable and verifiable. So how do you fit that into this grand scheme, which would seem to turn everything upside down?
Yes, yes. You'll see that what we use in here is not philosophy or make-believe or what-ifs. I actually hate what-ifs. We get letters all the time to Astronomy Magazine saying, well, what if black holes are really places where dark matter is falling in from another place? And you know, unless you can prove it, unless there's an experimental or observational way you can falsify an idea, then it's just more mind stuff. So this is not mind stuff. This is taking the actual experiments and data, especially since 1998, but even starting with the realm of quantum mechanics, and seeing what it's really telling us, and seeing that when we get these answers that are unsatisfying, for example, the universe is expanding into it's disappearing over a horizon where we can't observe it. Now, we know this is true, but it still means that at least 999 over 1,000 parts of the universe are unknown, that we're living in an unknown universe. We don't know how consciousness arose. We don't know how life arose. We don't know how the universe arose. We don't know what most of the universe is. And so one of the things to face is that we do not know the basic questions about this universe or reality or the nature of consciousness. Consciousness is a mystery. We don't even know how it begins in an individual, let alone collectively. And so facing what we don't know honestly allows us to look at the scientific evidence and see if there are better models that explain what we're seeing. Chief among them is space and time, because all of us picture a space and time-based framework. You know, we live on a planet separated from others. We live in a galaxy separated from others. The things that happened were caused by events that occurred a long time ago, by and large. So we use time and we use space to make sense of what we see. Once we see clearly that neither space nor time have a fundamental reality, and that our framework, our spatio-temporal framework, which is based on this, wobbles like smoke in a dream, it just wobbles and vanishes, we can find a better, more solid basis for our models of reality.
Only thumbing through it, since you brought it in 15 minutes before the show, I wonder, are you now, at points in this book, crossing into a religious realm?
Well, we have to acknowledge in the book, and we do, that there have been sages and philosophers, and especially in Eastern religions, that have been essentially saying our conclusion for thousands of years, and that this is an original. One of the conclusions is that the observer, that is life, and nature are correlative, that we go together. Now, this is not that different from the all is one philosophy of Eastern religion.
Mm-hmm.
So people have said this kind of thing before. The difference is that we're supporting this with science rather than supporting it with intuition or enlightenment experiences or what have you.
Well, I can't wait to read the book. There is a lot going on. You said there's a transit of Mercury going on?
Yeah, on Monday. Astronomers are really excited about it, and some of my astronomer colleagues are saying, this is the biggest event of the year.
But you can't look at it.
Yeah, I always see things through the public's viewpoint, and I'm wondering, well, how excited is the average person going to be when, unlike the transit of Venus in 2004 and 2012, this won't show up on the sun's surface, even if you have eye protection on. Of course, you have to have eye protection.
You better have eye protection.
Let's say the sun finally comes out for the first time in 2 weeks on Monday, and you can look at the sun. You still shouldn't look at the sun. We all know that. But with the transit of Venus, if you had welder's goggles or solar equipment, you could have seen Venus as a little dot. Mercury's 5 times smaller than Venus, so it will not show up. So you need a telescope with a solar filter, and how many people have that?
Right.
So I'd say the best bet is that your local astronomy club, just call them. For example, I know the Mid-Hudson Astronomy Club down in New Paltz will be setting up the correct instruments in front of the science building at SUNY New Paltz starting at 10 a.m. on Monday, and they're going to be out there for hours. This transit lasts 7 hours.
It does. So it takes Mercury 7 hours to cross the sun.
The sun.
Even given its very small orbit.
Yes,
very
exactly.
Interesting.
Usually happens only in November. And it rarely does it happen in May, so this is kind of an odd one. It happens 13 times a century, so it's not that common, although it's more common than Venus transits, which happen 13 times a millennium. But interestingly, once a transit happens in May, it will be always followed by a November transit 3.5 years later.
Oh, really?
So if it is cloudy or you don't want to get to an astronomy club and do that, you'll get another chance in November of 2019.
Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551. And then we will get to the phones. And everybody's on hold. And we'll start ticking off the list.
Support for WMT comes from Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire. Featuring paved stone to help construct outdoor living spaces, walkways, retaining walls, pool decks, edgers, fire pits, and more. WhitneysFarm.com. And Curtis Lumber, featuring Anderson Windows, Therma True Doors, Owens Corning Shingles, Valspar Paints, Cabot Stains, and more at 21 locations in New York and Northern Vermont. CurtisLumber.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number to call is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. And, Bob, we better get to the phones. Let's go over to Jeff in Gardner. Jeff, you're on.
Good afternoon, and thanks.
Sure.
I have a question about the Earth's orbit.
Sure.
I just recently learned that it takes longer to go from winter to summer than it takes to go from summer to winter by 6 days.
That's right. One half of the year is a week longer than the other half. I'm happy to report that it's the warm half of the year that's the longer half. In other words, if you cut the year into the half from equinox in March to equinox in September, the warm half, and compared that to the September equinox to the next March equinox, there's an extra week. And that's hidden. That's disguised by our calendar. It's disguised because the short half of the year has the short month of February.
Yeah.
The long half of the year has two 31-day months in a row, July and August. Plus, the September equinox happens on the 23rd, whereas the spring equinox happens on the 20th, so there we sneak in half a week right there, and then. So we sneak that in, and most people aren't aware of it. And the reason that happens is because Earth's orbit is elliptical, not round, which means, according to Kepler's second law, we speed up and we slow down, depending upon the part of our orbit. So our very fastest orbital speed happens the first week of January when we're at perihelion, our closest point to the sun. We whip around it. And that's our fastest speed. So that's almost equidistant from the two equinoxes in September and March. So we go through that year. We get that over with much faster.
You've divided the year differently. Thank you. I think that does help.
Sure.
I was arguing with my brother this morning, and we were just wondering if you happen to know if we thought like a major axis on the elliptical orbit. at that point on the major axis when it's closest, is that by any chance like December 21st, or is that by any chance when the Earth is moving fastest?
It's pretty close to it. Now,
okay,
if you're using the right term of major axis, in other words, the line along our long egg-shaped orbit, the longest line you could draw across our orbit is called the major axis, but it does not point to the spot on December 21st. It points to where we are about January 4th, which isn't terribly far from that point, but it's not exact.
Jeff, you and your brother must really have a heck of a nice conversation there. Must be a lot of fun at parties, huh? Thanks, man.
I guess we're old.
Yeah.
And he's an engineer.
Appreciate the call.
And I was reading Anthony Avini's book, Uncommon Sense, and it was real. I thought it was really interesting. And I couldn't believe I was 66 years old and I didn't know this. But you divided the year differently. I was thinking from winter to summer is longer by 6 days, and that's why at this time of year it feels like it takes forever. It's because there's an extra 6 days in there.
Yeah, that would you could divide it that way, too. But remember, our fastest speed around the sun. So the days whirling by, our axial rotation, that doesn't vary. It's always 23 hours, 56 minutes, 4.1 seconds. So each day is the same. So if you really wanted to see what's the longest half and what's the shortest half, you'd center the short half around that January 4th perihelion.
Okay.
All right.
Very good. Thank you.
Hey, Jeff, thanks a lot. Tell your brother that. Let's go to Bill in Greenville. Bill, you're on.
Sir, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not sure if it was an Arthur C. Clarke book. I believe it might have been 2010, possibly 2016. But in the story, the planet Jupiter was ignited somehow.
Yes.
A second small sun.
So yeah, funny you bring this up. Bob and I were talking about little stars before the show started.
Yeah, and it was 2010, his book.
Is that remotely possible?
Nope.
Could that not at all?
Right, not at all. Because Jupiter has it was 80 times less mass than it would require for it to have enough pressure in its core to have enough heat for the fusion process to begin. Most people don't realize it, but the sun's fusion generator is a tiny ball. It's not the sun itself. It's a tiny little ball in its center that's only 1/200th. The size of the whole sun. So there's this little tiny generator where I happen to have the figure in my head where 96 billion 1 megaton H-bombs worth of energy is released per second.
Yes, Bill.
Sir, I drive a school bus and the kids are just getting on the bus, so I'll just have to put you off the phone and listen on the radio.
Hey, but man, thanks a lot.
Thank you for my call.
I appreciate it. Now, listen, Bob, we were talking about the little stars because of the news that broke earlier this week about three Earth-sized planets thought to have surface temperatures which might allow liquid water that are orbiting a very dim dwarf star. And according to The Guardian, the science editor Ian Sample, the star is dubbed TRAPPIST-1. It's not much larger than Jupiter. That's what it says. Now, it doesn't quantify how much larger it is, but it says not much larger than Jupiter, emits a fraction of the sun's radiation. So is that 80 times?
Well, it could be. Remember, Jupiter is very fluffy. It has barely more than the density of water. Saturn, its sister planet, has less than the density of water. So the star that would be maybe a little larger than Jupiter could have a greater density, and therefore there could be more stuff in it. But the commonly recited figure is that you need 80 times Jupiter's mass in order to have a nuclear fusion process happening. So this is interesting because it's a little tiny faint star.
And it's only three light years away.
Yeah, and the three small planets that would have a temperature that would allow liquid water to form, that's what they're always looking for, can it have liquid water, would have to be only 1%, and the farthest one, only 3% of Earth's distance from the sun. So they're hugging that little dim star, and therefore they're getting enough warmth from being so close to it to have the right surface temperature.
So when you're that close, one side always stays parked, right?
No, well, that's an excellent point.
Doesn't Mercury do that?
Yeah, Mercury does that. We used to think Mercury does that. Actually, Mercury doesn't do that. Mercury has an 88-year orbit around the sun and a 59-year period of rotation.
Interesting.
We thought that until the early 60s.
Well, according to the news that broke this week, these planets are parked. So one side is hot. It's like a McDLT. The other side is cool.
Well, they don't know the spin rate of the planets. I don't know why they would say that. And here's another thing. You know, let's be clear about this. This press release would never have gotten outside of esoteric astronomy journal circles except for the current craze for exoplanets. In fact, I have the press release in front of me, and the lead researcher said, there could be liquid water on the surfaces, but we don't know. But maybe there could be life there. In other words, we don't know.
Yeah, it's, but the beauty of this, as I understand it, is that because that star, is so dim, it's not emitting the usual bath of radiation and light that makes it tough for our devices to measure any possible atmosphere on these planets. It's much easier to do that, and it's also fairly close at 40 light years away.
Right, 40 light years. We like that.
All right, 800-348-2551. Let's go back to the phones. Sean in Kinderhook. Sean.
Hey, I had a question. The solution, I think, to the mission to Mars, why don't they build a base on the moon and then build a base on the moon, Phobos? And then that way you kind of have like a temporary way station and all the stuff can be ship there and then ship down.
Well, if you're going to ship it to Phobos, why not just go the extra 12 miles or whatever it is?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I thought that it might be more realistic to have a base on both moons. I think that it would be easier to travel there.
Well, that's what we're going to do eventually with Jupiter, of course. It's Galilean satellites would be the obvious place for a base to study Jupiter. At least the outermost of those, Callisto, is outside of Jupiter's fierce and lethal radiation belts.
But that's a good point.
But when we're coming to Mars, what Ray said is really quite true, because anytime you slow up and then have to take off again, even from a very low mass object like Phobos, but especially from our moon, which is not nothing, you'd have to have extra fuel.
But I suppose it might make sense if you could manufacture things under low gravity on one of those moons.
If you could, then you're talking about manufacturing, and then you need equipment for the manufacturing. You're adding a process. I have no doubt that when we go to Mars, it will be directly landing, probably supplying future astronauts with food, with habitation. All these things are going to be set up, and then once everything is now safe and sound on the planet, then you send the astronauts. And as you know, some are even talking about it being a one-way trip. We've discussed that in the past.
Yeah, well, that's crazy, a one-way trip. Can they build a biodome there on the surface and grow vegetables and food?
You mean like in the movie The Martian?
Yeah, I didn't see that movie, but
that's what Matt Damon did. He grew potatoes.
You're pretty skeptical, Bob, about this whole manned mission to Mars.
No, not manned mission. That's almost certainly going to be done. I think if we don't do it, the Chinese will do it, because it's the only place to send people that we haven't gone, really. I mean, nobody's interested in landing on an asteroid very much or the body of a comet. It will be Mars sooner or later. The only thing I'm skeptical of is terraforming. That's what I think will never happen.
Well, Sean, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
800-348-2551. I saw in the news either today or yesterday one of the commercial space ventures, and I forget which one.
SpaceX is planning to go there.
An unmanned mission by 2018.
Yeah, and they'll do it, too.
Okay. To what end? We already have sent unmanned missions.
They may want to leapfrog ahead of us. They may want to get their foot in the door to NASA, not just to do what they're doing, which is having the contract to resupply the International Space Station, but maybe get the contract to actually send people to Mars and take it out of the hands of NASA.
Now, how long of a flight are we talking about?
6 months.
6 months there and 6 months back.
Right.
Well, that's not too bad.
Right. And there are windows called the home and transfer orbit that makes it easy to do every 26 months.
Based on?
The positions of the two planets.
The whipping around, as you say?
Yeah, well, what you do is you send a craft that's essentially in orbit around the sun, and the minimum energy orbit has its closest point to the sun, or perihelion, at Earth's orbit distance, and its aphelion, its farthest point from the sun, at the Martian distance.
Ah.
And so, but just as the spacecraft reaches the Martian orbit, Mars also gets to that spot.
Ah.
Otherwise, it would have been dumb,
Take a long time.
So
yeah.
We get there just as Mars gets there, and that's the absolute minimum rocket fuel energy way to get to Mars, and we get that configuration every 2 years and 2 months. So that, which is why we send probes to Mars with that spacing between them.
By the way, have you been following at all this sort of strange hypotheses slash fact about this Planet Nine?
Yeah, that's interesting, and there's good mathematics behind it, that there are some dwarf objects in the outer solar system. They're not official dwarf planets, but they're icy bodies in the Kuiper Belt that have odd orbits around the sun that have been explained mathematically. Six objects that would make sense, their orbits would make sense if they're being tugged at by an unseen massive planet, maybe 10 times more massive than Earth, that's way out there. You know, Pluto averages 40 Earth-Sun distances away, 40 astronomical units. This would be 700 astronomical units. So we're talking about almost 20 times farther away than Pluto, almost the unimaginable distances of space, a massive planet. And if it exists, we don't know if it does. There have been false alarms before where the math looked good and it didn't pan out. But if this pans out, it would explain some oddities we're seeing in these in the orbits of these little objects that are closer in.
And there was some question, there are many questions, but one of the questions is, if it exists, how it got there. And one theory was that it was a rogue planet that sort of got parked in our solar system.
Yeah.
A lot of people say that's
unlikely.
A very, very low probability. Another probability or possibility is that it was much closer and that some interaction between Jupiter and Saturn just kicked it out into a far
that
orbit.
That could do it, too. Comet Halley, you know, there's a meteor shower tonight and tomorrow night. I hate to say it because it's overcast and likely to stay that way the next two nights. But a meteor shower that's not a bad one, that's caused by pieces from Halley's comet that are hitting us. So Halley's comet is in my mind at this moment. And do you know, its orbit changes from about 75 to 76 years. Almost every time it orbits the sun, it has a different period and a different path because of Jupiter and, to a lesser extent, Saturn tweaking its orbit.
Oh, interesting.
So it keeps changing. So if it came too close, of course, it could be hurled outward, just as this object maybe was.
All right, let's go get a call or two in before the next break, and let's go to Jeff in, I think, Montague, New Jersey. You're on, Jeff.
Yes, thank you. Does the rotating magma inside the Earth's core change its magnetic field, therefore affecting our weather patterns?
Well, it does change its magnetic field on an average every 380,000 years, three times per million years. And digging down, we've found, if I remember right, over 150 reversals of our magnetic field lines. It should be said that the kind of New Age thought that maybe our poles are flipping now.
Yeah.
And we're in for trouble. It should be pointed out that it takes about 10,000 years for a magnetic reversal of our field caused by that magma, by the way. It's not actually magma, but it's the core. It's a nickel iron liquid core.
Yeah.
It takes 10,000 years to assert itself. So this isn't something that's going to happen while you're having a latte, you know, overnight in a day or two. It's a very slow process. But we have found, thanks to studying the field lines, the magnetic lines in rock that has solidified, our own magma or lava that comes out of volcanoes, as it solidifies, as soon as it gets below a certain temperature, I happen to remember it's 1,414 degrees.
Of course you remembered that.
Fahrenheit, 1414, can't forget that.
Right.
As soon as it gets below that temperature, called the Curie temperature, by the way, then it'll freeze Earth's magnetic field into that iron
right.
in the rock.
So it's a record.
The part, like a record. Yeah. So we've dug down and excitedly found over 100 instances of our poles flipping their orientation over time. And at first we were very excited. What causes it? Is it impacts? Does it correlate with life, with periods of mass extinctions, with sea level rises? with, you know, the impacts of meteors and comets on Earth. But the more we find, the more we find that, no, it doesn't correlate with anything, including any effect on the biology of Earth.
Right.
So it seems to be independent of that and not harmful in any way.
Not a big deal.
But as our caller pointed out, yes, it is due to that interplay, no doubt, still mysterious, by the way, between the solid ball we have in the middle of Earth. We used to think we had a liquid core in the middle of Earth. Now we know it's a little solid ball about the size of Pluto that, by the way, spins faster than the rest of Earth. So it's like we have a planet inside our planet that spins a little faster than the rest of the planet. It's great stuff.
Yeah, it is great. Hey, thanks for the call, Jeff. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. The new book, just out this month, is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Time, Space, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death by Robert Lanza and our guest today, Bob Berman. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Support for WMT comes from Poughkeepsie Farm Project, hosting their annual plant event May 7th and 14th. Over 200 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs raised in their greenhouse, family activities, farmproject.org. Interactive Media Consulting, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing logo and print design, web design, and digital marketing throughout the capital region and beyond, marketing creative and business ideas since 1996, imediaconsult.com. The Wild Center, dedicated to building a stronger connection between people and the natural world, wildcenter.org for details. George Heigl, Cowan's representative, specializing in evaluating, marketing, buying, and selling of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, and more, 518-369-7994. And the Ashokan Center, building community through shared experiences in nature, history, and the arts, outdoor education programs for schools and retreat opportunities. Where nature inspires, ashokancenter.org to learn more.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Nice to have you with us today. The number to call is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Bob Berman, whose new book, Beyond Biocentrism, is now out, soon to be in 300 languages. The way your books go, it'll be all over. It'll be in the airports in China in no time. Hey, this one came in via email at voxpop@wamc.org from Peter, who starts out by saying, gentlemen. And first I'll say, Peter, you're way off. When considering the settlement of Mars, as bad as the atmosphere might get on Earth, aren't our currently underpopulated deserts more reasonable locales for human habitation than Mars? I remember when the Cosmos guy, Carl Sagan, volunteered for an unmanned mission to Mars. Well, how could he volunteer for an unmanned mission to Mars? We'll just say for a manned mission to Mars. All right, so any comment on that?
Yeah, Peter's absolutely right. You know, people are not lining up, no matter how overpopulated we get. Nobody's lining up to live in the Gobi Desert or the Sahara or on top of the Himalayas or underneath the ocean. There's lots of places on Earth. Even under the ocean is more hospitable than Mars, as Peter correctly pointed out, its atmosphere is 1% of ours, which is essentially a vacuum, and that little 1% has no oxygen. It's all carbon dioxide. So, and it's radiation suffused,
right.
So much so that Shannon Lucid, our longest tenured astronaut, woman astronaut in space, has repeatedly regarded that as a stopper. That the human brain could be destroyed, as much as 13% destroyed in a 2-year mission.
Can't you just wear a lead-lined helmet?
That wouldn't be fun. It would be like going to Hawaii and staying in the lobby of the hotel. You know, you want to be out there exploring and seeing.
Well, you can be, but if you got the gravity's how much less?
It's about 3/8 of what we've got.
So you put a thin coating of lead inside the helmet, you walk around, right?
I think Peter's right. I think as a place to go, and I know you're gung-ho to
no,
explore.
No, I'm not.
We're going to go there. We have to do it. It's sort of in our genes to do that.
Yeah.
But so far as colonizing it and having people go because we're too crowded, if you just think of the costs and the lack of medical facilities and not being able to get any decent pizza and just how hard it is to stay alive there compared to the deserts of Earth. Wow, there's lots of, you know, there's millions
the
of square
though.
Miles or locally. That would be a lot
but
easier.
It's the quest for knowledge, Bob. I mean, you can, people
but
have
not
gone.
For colonization.
I mean, heck, they go to Vegas every day. That's
but
in
not,
the desert.
But we're talking about colonization. You know, okay. That's not for knowledge. That's for, like, wanting a new place to hang out. It's like the Alaska syndrome.
Okay.
You know, you want to go somewhere that's, you know.
All right, I dig it. All right, this one came in via email. Then we'll get back to the phones. David in Cambridge, you'll be next. This is from Kermit in Pittsfield. Recently reading a number of different items and focusing on the best way to measure time, several physicists have focused on degradation of certain elements as the best metric by which to determine time. My less than adequate scientific background and thought is that time is a byproduct of events, not simply the degradation of a particular ion or element or similar. I see time as a kind of pegboard which holds on to these things, and even the future is just our transiting through the past and history of something that preceded us. What are your thoughts, Kermit? That's deep, man. That's
yeah.
deep.
What Kermit is really, when he's saying a pegboard, he's kind of expressing the view that Isaac Newton had, which is that time is a real thing, that events flow through. But other people, equally smart people, I think, like Immanuel Kant, have said that no, it's something that we create. It's along the lines of our numbering system. It's something that we create to make sense of the what we now know to be an avalanche of electrical signals pouring through our brains, and we order them. And when we see change, we call it time, that these things happen just as these things are happening. And indeed, that's how we officially mark time. We use a certain isotope of cesium, and its nucleus vibrates exactly. If it's exposed only to a particular kind of infrared pulse, microwave pulse, it'll vibrate 9,192,631,770 times a second. So we define a second as being that many pulses of electromagnetic radiation, because it's happening at the same time that the cesium atom is doing something else. So we take simultaneous events. And instead of just saying, yeah, a candle burns down an inch while Earth rotates 1/12 of its turn, while something else while the heart beats so many times, instead of just saying those things happen together, we say, well, let's call that a half hour. But that doesn't mean that a half hour is a real thing,
yeah.
like a tomato, you know, that you can take to a lab and measure. So most scientists don't regard time as an actual entity, but a tool of animal perception. We certainly do in our book. We see it as something that we carry with us, like a turtle with shells.
Yeah. Well, a ghost once told me that time is a medium, and that it is a method. Basically, the ghost didn't say, the ghost just said, you're doing very well across the medium of time. True story. So I've looked this up, but I can only assume that then time would be a way of transmitting information.
Wait a minute. A true story that a ghost told
yeah.
you something? A
yeah.
ghost something once told you something?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you that off the air. Let's okay. go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. David in Cambridge. David, you're on.
Hi. I don't like to hear more about the ghost.
I'll tell you sometime.
But, ectoplasm is going to be quite interesting. First of all, to my mom who is listening, and by the way, loves the song Stardust. Hi, Mom, if you please. About your book, it's sort of interesting. I mean, the 20th century has been kind of an interesting time, speaking of which, where what you're saying seems to, now I've not touched your book, so how should I know, but I'm just guessing from the cryptology that you probably touch upon some of the works of Vernon Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle, and how he seems to stress, to some degree, we have a bit of a two-way or a symbiotic relationship with the universe by having an effect by simply observing the experiment.
Yeah, absolutely true.
That's in the book.
He's in there. He's in the book, too. But what I would say is that, you know, when we come out with just the conclusion, you know, and Ray read it to you, you know, time, space, consciousness, the illusion of death, it could seem like, well, what is this? Is this philosophy? Is it Eastern religion? Is there some science? Is it real science? Because sometimes quantum mechanics is used not properly. It's used to say that there was a movie, What the Bleep Do We Know, some years back, in which they claim that quantum theory tells you that you can control your own future. And quantum mechanics says no such thing. So we're being very careful to use real science. I think this is one reason we have the all this support and these testimonials from these Harvard and Dartmouth and others, to really be careful and to say what's real and what isn't, and just really give you the facts. And I think once we build up the case, you'll come to the same conclusion that we do about time and space and the role of the observer in the experiment. And it's just as you're saying, David,
David
is it?
Cambridge, David, yeah.
It's just as you're saying. And but it's one thing to kind of put it forth and the other to be convinced of it.
David, thanks for the call. Let's go to Gloria in Cambridge. Gloria, you're on.
Yes, hi, and thank you very much for taking my call. It's a pleasure to listen to you. Please, Christian, I'm just wondering, you were talking about Mercury transiting the sun?
Yes.
Earlier?
Yes.
Does it have any effect on people on this planet?
Well, you know, it's great that you're saying that, because lately a lot of people have been mentioning to me Mercury in retrograde. I know you know that term, right? The caller?
Yep.
Yeah. And this comes back from the old ancient practice of astrology, when it was initially thought that the planets were gods, not bodies of rock and
right.
metal, and that they were all circling Earth, and that they all affected us, because there were only five of them in the sky, and it was thought that, well, it must influence our daily lives. And so when Mercury, instead of going the normal direction against the background constellations, and that is towards the east, for a while goes backwards. Well, what does that mean? Mercury's in retrograde. It must affect my romances or my health or something. But we now know, of course, that it's not circling the Earth. It's circling the sun. And anything that circles the sun from our perspective is going to go one way when it's on the far side of the orbit. And then when it's in front of the sun the way it is now, it's going to go the other way, because
okay.
it's just going round and round and round.
All right.
Nothing. In other words, nothing is happening that's in any way unusual. And it's a little tiny body, the smallest of the planets. And it's far away. And it's just made of ordinary rocks. So it does not affect our lives.
Wait
doesn't
a minute,
affect
Bob.
Our health. And wait a minute. Back in the 70s, when computers started to become available, countless interesting studies were done on supposed planetary effects on us, different configurations, and they were all negative.
Okay.
So if you talk to anyone in the sciences, they'll tell you these are old superstitions, that there's nothing to it.
I'm with you there, man. But you can't call the planets just old rocks. Now,
no,
they're alive, right? Everything's alive. Biocentrism, you're being very biocentrist if you're
all
saying
right.
that these planets are not alive.
Okay.
No, you don't buy that?
Not that they're really alive in the sense.
But everything's alive, right? Isn't that the basis of what we're saying?
Next time we'll talk about this, and you'll see in what sense.
So you want me to read the book?
Life.
Do the homework. All right, fine. You know you're no fun. Let's go to Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Okay, thank you, guys. Sometime within the last month, I think I heard on the radio about some group that's sending out a space probe well beyond the solar system, and they're going to achieve amazing speed with this by using lasers to propel it. And I can't figure out how that would work.
Okay, I'll tell you how it'll work. And I've been skeptical. You know, Ray has been talking to me about my skepticism about terraforming Mars, so I don't want to throw more skepticism. And I saw the press release on that. I don't think it's ever going to happen. First of all, it's a billionaire who is proposing this project, essentially to send little probes that each weigh an ounce.
An ounce
yeah. each into orbit, so that there's dozens or hundreds of them. Each have a camera, and then each has this giant kind of sail that unfurls. Then on Earth, a laser array is built, and we're talking about an array that would be 1 mile of lasers, each capable of more power than an entire nuclear power plant
produces.
Okay,
so that's a lot of energy.
Sending all this energy simultaneously, all those lasers, to the sail. Also, oh, by the way, the sail has to be of a material that reflects 100% of it, because if it absorbed even one part in a thousandth of the energy, it would just burn up
right.
and it would be useless. So it has to be a new material that we've never heard of.
So not like aluminum foil.
So right. there's nothing really to it.
No. So it would reflect it would catch the laser beam and then within a few seconds, really, certainly within 2 minutes, be accelerated to 1/6 the speed of light. And because of that, it would reach the nearest star in about 24 years.
Well,
the only
great.
Problem is it can't be steered. Of course, can't slow down. It doesn't have any propulsion. So it's just a rough kind of aiming. We're throwing it roughly in the direction, and it's very likely to miss the star. But even if it goes somewhere near it, what is it really going to tell us with its cameras? The idea is to see whether there are any planets, which would show up as little dots.
I see.
Now, it's estimated it'll cost $10 billion, take 20 years to develop, need technologies that don't even exist. So I'll let you be the judge as to whether this thing's really going to happen or whether it even should happen, whether it's worth that much money.
Well, he's
money
a billionaire and he's
it.
Got the money to spend. What the heck, right?
That's right.
Let's talk about something more plausible, I guess.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Hey, Richard, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. But there are those devices out there in space that do use sails, but they take the solar wind, right?
Exactly.
It just takes longer to accelerate.
Yes.
But you would theoretically, if you go long enough, get up a good head of steam.
Exactly. It's a very slow but steady process. We've already done that with, I think it was called Spaceship One. My goodness, it was about 8-10 years ago. But we actually sent a space probe to the comet Vilt 1, or was it Vilt 2?
I don't know. Offhand.
I think it was Vilt 1, W-I-L-T, using that method of
there you go.
Propulsion.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Robin in Albany,
no,
Robin.
Actually, that used ions.
Oh, the ion drive.
Yeah, they use an ion drive.
Okay. Well, Robin, you're still on. Hi.
All right. Hi there. I feel comparatively boring today. I'd love to ask about the book, but I don't feel like I have the grounding in it to do it. So
well, next time.
To that next
yeah.
session.
Okay.
But I should read it. What I did want to ask about, you got me thinking with Jupiter, but I'm always curious about the rest of the volume of Jupiter. So we've all been given a basic understanding that the surface of it is roiling storms that I'm sure are, you know, several Earths deep or whatever. But what's under that? Because most of the volume of Jupiter is under there.
Is there any solid?
It's not all that dense.
No. It's huge. It's 88,600 miles in diameter. It's 11 Earths in diameter, which means if you're going to work out the volume, you know, it's you have to go with the cube. So you figure about 1,000 Earths would fit inside of it. No, it's hydrogen and helium. We know that all the way down the surface, a little bit of ammonia, a little bit of methane, a little tiny bit of water vapor mixed in. And there's something, probably phosphorus, that's causing the red spot to be red. I spoke with Carolyn Porco, who's one of the great planetary astronomers. And I said, why is the red spot red?
Yeah.
And she said, you know, we don't know. Could be a sulfur compound, could be a phosphorus, it could be phosgene. So we're not even sure about that. But you might get to a tiny, solid, compressed ball of hydrogen where the pressure is so great at the center of Jupiter that hydrogen assumes its solid guise, in which case it could have a little solid a core. And who knows, maybe there's even a little rocky core down there. That would be so far down, there's probably no way we could even know. But it's mostly hydrogen and helium.
Are any of the gas giants with a solid core?
Not that we know of, unless they're solid, made up of those materials. Essentially the same thing the sun is made of. Hydrogen, helium, and a little leftover ammonia and methane.
So even if you set off an enormous hydrogen bomb in the center of Jupiter, it would not ignite in a chain reaction?
It doesn't have the pressure and the temperature to sustain it.
But it has the hydrogen and helium,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but remember, the hydrogen in a hydrogen bomb, it's not plain hydrogen, it's deuterium. You use an enriched type with an extra neutron, and it's the neutrons that are bouncing around that start the whole process going. So you can't just use ordinary hydrogen.
Okay. Well, Bob, nice to have you here. The new book is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Time, Space, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death. And I'll, for my homework, read this before you're on next, provided you're not on in the next 2 weeks.
And I do want to mention my co-author, Robert Lanza, who is famous for stem cell research, you know, the cloning type thing.
He
was in Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. So I don't want to give him short shrift.
No, and so do you think you have any chance of getting on that list now?
Ha.
Like maybe 101, 104, or something like that?
Ha. But bless you for saying that.
All right, Bob. Well, nice to have you here. And thanks to everybody who listened and called in. Support comes from Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting Blessed is the Match, the Life and Death of Hannah Senesh. A young poet returns to rescue her Jewish community in 1944. Sunday, May 15th, 7 p.m. at Temple Sinai. Reception to follow. 518-584-8730, option 2 for tickets. Unusual wedding rings at Moore, 137 North Street, downtown Pittsfield, announcing their retirement and store closing after 36 years. Public and private showings open Tuesday through Saturday, 413-236-9300 for appointments. And Larac, serving the arts community year-round in downtown Glens Falls since 1972 with gallery exhibits and gift shop featuring handmade items by regional artists, larac.org. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thanks again to you for listening and for all the great calls and the email. Thanks to Zachary T. Malloy, our engineer. Your calls were answered by Deb Malik, our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Today is Thursday. That means tomorrow is Friday. That means tomorrow is a Food Friday. This is exciting stuff. Stay tuned now for news.